Good morning, friends. We are here living in the light. I'm Asha Nayaswami. Let's pray together. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, we offer our lives in service and devotion to you. Help us to feel your presence in our hearts, that being attuned is no effort, but is the natural expression of our heart's natural love. We are your children. Help us to feel your closeness to us and your unconditional love, that we may move through this world, even through the darkest, most confusing moments, in a spirit of love and kindness and freedom with thee. Om. Peace. Amen. So, we are working with this little pamphlet called A New Dispensation, and I've managed to get a PDF of it, which is going to be somewhere where you can find it, so you'll also be able to read it if you don't have your own copy. Swami wrote this as what he felt was a very important revelation when it came to him, and I'm going to work with this, I think, by just reading sections of it. I thought there was a date on this. This is sort of... It was written as a letter, and I thought that he just wrote... Nope, there's just not a scrap. I'll have to find the date, because I know it's somewhere. He wrote this out as a letter, and it says... I'll read a few paragraphs and then comment. The first part is really interesting. Dear friend, I have a discovery to share with you, something exciting, in fact, wonderful. It's a discovery I've come upon not in a sudden flash, but gradually, with a growing sense of awe, over a period of many years. I touched on this discovery in my book, The Path. In a chapter titled, God Protects His Devotees, I stated, in the almost 30 years that I have been on this path of self-realization, I cannot recall to mind a single instance where a disciple of Paramhansa Yogananda has failed to find protection in time of real need. Considering the length of time involved and the thousands of disciples I have known during this period, this is quite an amazing record. My reference in that chapter, backed with example after example, was to protection in the face of danger. Well, over the 6 years since I wrote that book, so that would mean he finished the book in 77, so this would be 1983. Well, over the 6 years since I wrote that book, I've realized that my claim, startling though many a reader must have found it, barely scratched the surface. Much more than protection is involved. Divine power, increasing inner security and joy, freedom from mental and emotional delusions, an ability to ride the storms of destiny instead of being driven by them helplessly, a sense of belonging at last, meaningfully so, in the universal scheme of things. In what has often been described as an age of alienation and loneliness, how wonderful to find a way out that is at the same time a way in, into deeper attunement with life, with love, with one's fellow man, with God. Well, I'm going to just stop there for a few minutes. In this book, and I'm pulling out the original, when he goes to God Protects His Devotee, the chapter, wherever that is, he talks about, driving over a cliff and, going down the hill at Mount Washington, having the brakes fail, and various other situations like that where life was just... where life was really on the line, and Master saved us. Oh, the Anandamoy or one of the monks, climbing up a steep ladder to the second story to plaster the building with a hod of plaster on his back, and the weight of the plaster being so great that it pulled the ladder over backwards. And so it's about to fall flat on his back with this huge load of plaster. He starts calling Master's name, and all of a sudden it goes forward like that. It's just like it's past the tipping point, and then it goes back. And the man driving down the mountain, it was Norman Paulson driving down the mountain. The brakes are gone like that. Again, he calls Master's name, and the car comes to a stop like that. At Ananda Village, there was a man, when I was saying, driving over the cliff, and he was going down to across the Yuba River in a big, heavy truck. I think that was when they was running a lumber business. The truck went off the road like that, just started down into the canyon, and the big truck just sort of was stopped by this small bush. Just ran into this bush, and it just stopped. There was no relationship between the size of the truck and the size of the bush. That's what happened. That was the year we created, this is like in the early years of Ananda, this would have been in the early 70s. That year we awarded the man the Most Dramatic Karma of the Year award. I gave him a little certificate, and a number of us signed it, and there was a little, you know, sort of policy instructions. Although there is no absolute prohibition against winning this award 2 years in a row, it is not recommended. There was actually also Ananda, a man who was doing tree trimming. He fell like 60 feet, just straight down, and just didn't even break a bone. Just got up and walked away. Another woman was at a job site. That was when they were building Swami's apartment. And they were building a basement. She fell off the ledge. In this case, she was hurt. She fell onto a piece of rebar, and it went sort of in her inner thigh. But when, you know, they took her to the hospital and the doctor worked on it, he said a surgeon couldn't have made a more careful cut. He said every major artery, everything that could have made this into either a fatal or at least a extremely debilitating accident, none of that happened. It happened just exactly within millimeters of what it needed to be to have it be inconvenient and unpleasant, but in no way either life-threatening or life-debilitating. These are just the examples that I'm thinking of. Now, Swamiji never speaks in hyperbole. So is that a hyperbole on my part to say that? He never does. But he never did, ever, because truth was exceedingly important to him. Nor did Swamiji ever resort to drama in order to make his point. You know, sometimes people, the way I thought of it when I would watch Swami talk, especially when I would see him on a platform with other well-known teachers, Swami never resorted to two things that I would consider myself guilty of at times, although I hope I've grown out of it now. People using personal charm in order to attract you. It's something subtle because, you know, when you get on the spiritual path and you begin to love God, a certain kind of magnetism just comes out of you that's not your personality. It's what Swami, actually he talks about it in the next paragraphs, this sort of certain radiance and enthusiasm and joyous love for God, which is a natural consequence of the life we lead. But there's another way that people use personal charm in order to attract people. I didn't understand that when I was younger, but I've come to understand it as I've grown older. And a lot of public speakers use personal charm. And it's not bad. If they're charming, it's quite fun. They have nice personalities. But what you're attracted to is not their message. What you're attracted to is the person who's charming, who's delivering it. And maybe you're also attracted to the message, but there's a fine line. I'm just going to leave it there. There's another way that you can attract people to what you're saying, and that's by emotion. By building up emotion, by getting people excited in certain ways, by forcing them into catharsis or, you know, just using emotional responses. Especially, and I'll go back into my early days when all of this teaching was very new, people would, they would have these cathartic weekends or these cathartic evenings, and there would be a big emotional release of a certain kind, which was not, it's not that it didn't happen. It's just, it's not the kind of lasting change that Kriya Yoga will give you. If it's one big emotional moment, it's just as likely to be one big emotional collapse after that. Because in order for us to genuinely shift karma, we have to have as much energy for the new reality as has been committed to the old reality. So in theory, one could generate sufficient energy to completely transform yourself in a split second. But an emotional excitement is not usually, well, let me say it differently. It has to be more than emotional excitement for it to actually really neutralize long-standing karma. So people can have a sense of release and even have a certain progress, but it doesn't really wipe out the vrittis in the chakra. So all of these things are things that certainly I, in the roles that I've played over the years, have had to mature into understanding. And as I began to mature into understanding, I began to watch Swami Kriyananda. He has a lot of feeling when he speaks. He has a great love for God, but he never lets his presentation move over into some kind of an emotional appeal. And nor does he ever speak in hyperbole. He never promises more than is possible. He always speaks the truth. So even when he wrote this chapter about God protects the devotees and made what he quotes here, these statements, in all my years, I've seen that in all the disciples I've known, in times of real need, the master is there. Now, of course, there's that little fine line, because it's not like master will save you from every difficulty. There was a disciple of master's named Mr. Cuaron. Cuaron was from Mexico, and he was the head of the SRF group in Mexico City. And he had been very wealthy, but lost his job for one reason or another and fell on, comparatively speaking, hard times economically. And there's a story which is also in the path, actually. This is, I might even be in God Protects the Devotee. And Mr. Cuaron was very anxious to reestablish his career and reestablish his financial well-being. And he was offered this wonderful job. And he was extremely happy about it. And just as a matter of just almost, you know, proper form, he wrote to Master saying, I've no great new opportunity. I'm taking this new job. And he was startled. I believe he got a telegram back from Master. Absolutely under no circumstances accept that job. Well, Cuaron was a little bit annoyed because it was a great job offer and he really needed it. But because Master had been so emphatic, he had to agree, so he didn't take the job. So the man who took it after him, it turned out that the company had done some very dishonest things, and the new man that was hired, all the guilty parties shifted the blame on him. And the new man was in very serious and got in terrible legal trouble, being completely innocent, but he had been hired by nefarious people who were setting him up to take the fall. And Cuaron was spared of that. Now, Swami adds about Mr. Cuaron. Mr. Cuaron never achieved the same level of wealth that he had had before, but he never lacked either. So it's not as if what Swamiji is saying here is that Master will fulfill all our desires in the way we want them fulfilled, but there is a level of protection. Protection in times of real need. Swami actually tells an extremely sweet story, which many of you have heard, but in this context it's worth mentioning. Goswami had his own miracle of having his life saved when he was in India around 1960. He was there for 4 years from 58 to 1962. And he said at one of the times he was setting up for a satsang, and he was setting up a microphone, and in some way he had both his hands on the metal wire. And there was some kind of a short in the system. I don't have the details straight, but an electric current, which was a 220 current, went through his body because he was holding on like this. And he said, that kind of current causes your muscles to contract. So he wasn't able to let go because his muscles contracted because of the electricity. And it would have been fatal. But in that very second, the fuse blew. And so he had the jolt, but he didn't have the death experience. He said he had a heart murmur. He's not sure if it actually was created by that or not, but he felt there was some lasting effect of it, but his life was spared. So Swami tells that story as his own example. And then he tells another story about having a lingering desire for some Swiss chocolate, which is something he'd enjoyed as a child. And he tells the whole story of, you know, just never remembering to write to his parents to ask for it. It would have been very easy. And his birthday was coming around, and he thought, oh, it would be so nice to have had some chocolate for my birthday. Swamiji was very interesting. He paid attention to many little things in life. You think that a yogi just disregards everything. But Swamiji enjoyed the flow of life. He didn't stand outside of it. He entered into it completely. It was partly because he was the leader of a community. Now, let me really say this out honestly. I was going to say it. It's because he'd been a king. There's stories of him both when he was Alfonso X in Spain and when he was Henry I in England about what a wonderful court he ran. And what that means is, you know, the king was the center of the life of the nobility and the aristocracy, and these were the people who led and governed the country. This is long before the age of democracy. So his influence on all those people was going to be the influence that would spread out and define the country. So how he ran his court was how he ran his country. And in both cases, it was a place of enormous refinement, erudition, imagination, creativity, artistic expression, musicality, poetry. So he set the tone very high, and then it spread out throughout his kingdom. And in both cases, his kingdoms were well run, and his people were very happy. In England, it was the longest period of peace and prosperity. I don't know if it's still true, but it, up until that point, when Henry was the king, his 30 years of rule. So I started to say, of course, that's what he was doing at Ananda. I was going to say, because he was a king, he had that left over. But what am I saying? He was still a king. He was the leader of this entire movement, and it was necessary for him to define the movement of self-realization in the West through his particular discipleship to master, and therefore the lineage of master. He had to define it in such a way that it would carry not only the details, but also the spirit of what master wanted us to be. And what Dwapara Yuga asks us to be, you see, is spirituality integrated into life. In Kali Yuga, we had what I would consider the luxury of just turning our backs on society, just not paying any attention to it, because it was Kali Yuga sinking. And so what was the point? There was no point in trying to build anything in an external way. Everything had to be, in fact, hidden and held, because it was just going, the barbarians were just going to sweep through and burn the libraries and destroy everything. So the real power had to be just in the individual spirit, literally waiting for a time when it could come out again, which is now, because in 1700 we started shifting into Dwapara Yuga. And you know, right after that is when all of this movement, America, was founded, and this whole movement of Dwapara Yuga started. So we're the Dwapara Yuga expression, and this a new dispensation, which is obviously going to take us a while to go through, is how, what does that really look like in practical life? So coming all the way back to Swami and his Swiss chocolates, he just had an affection for these Swiss chocolates, and he thought how nice it would be to have some, rather than thinking, I'm a yogi, I shouldn't want these things, I repudiate chocolates forever. You know, it was just a natural part of who he was. It's amazing to me when I think about this, and this, what I love about talking to you all like this is, it teaches me things. I know that Swami said after Master died, because he knew he was going to have to write about Master, he collected stories. He talked to all the disciples. He wrote down everything he could remember, you know, and built up this archive of material. The day he started writing the path, I talk about this in Light Bearer, he had spread all of these notes out on the floor, and they were in stacks all over the floor. And when we came to his house that afternoon, Swami was sitting on the floor amidst all that paper, and without rising from the floor, I remember he just looked up at me and looked at all of that and said, "How am I ever going to turn this into a book about Master?" And he later spoke of the ant trying to describe Mount Everest. You know, what, from the perspective of the ant, what could he say? But he did. He just persevered. And actually, that moment with Swamiji gave me courage when I was confronted with far bigger piles, many bigger piles, and had the same thought, how am I ever going to turn this into a book? How is the ant ever going to do it? And the answer was really simple, which was the same answer as Swami, is that I didn't, he did. And so here it is. I typed it, that's a fact, but that's all I did. In any case, but Swami told me that he told everybody. He said, I meditated for years on every one of those instances. Well, did he say everyone? I don't want to use hyperbole. He said, I meditated on the things Master said and the incidents of his life until I felt I had drawn the deepest meaning from them. And of course, I am constantly, as you hear from me all the time, I'm constantly replaying these. And what I was just realizing just now is even in his interest in those Swiss chocolates, in a way that I never really thought of, he was also just calmly illustrating to us what it is to be a deeply spiritual person. Because it's not so simple a question. I find that a great deal of help that I try to give people is to help them to understand that there's nothing actually wrong with what they're going through, because there's such a tendency to be self-critical or to feel that somehow we've failed. I don't know where that comes from, but it's deeply inculcated, especially in American Western society. Well, I know where it comes from. It comes from the fact that from a very young age, we are bombarded with advertisements. And those advertisements are always trying to tell us that whatever we are is inadequate. Because if it was adequate, we wouldn't buy their products. It's just as simple as that. We buy it because a desire is awakened and we think we need something. I heard this as a true story. I read it somewhere as a true story. That when some American, I believe it was an American fruit company, was setting up operations south of the border. I believe it was Mexico. Forgive me if any of these are wrong. But it was a country that wasn't that aggressive materialistically. They were into the quality of life. And this American company was trying to set up factories and plantations or whatever it was. And people only wanted to work a few months of the year, because they would get enough money and they could live quite happily and comfortably, and then they would enjoy their families and whatever else they wanted to do. But the American companies wanted there to be more aggressive work put out. So what they did is they started sending to the, and this is the way the story was told, to the women, the mail order catalogs from Sears. And then the women would turn the pages and see things that they wanted. But in order to get them, they had to work more to get more money. Now, is this an apocryphal tale or is this a true tale? I remember it being told to me as a true story. Whether it was Mexico, whether it was some other country, I really don't know. But that was how the story was told, because if I don't need anything, I don't need to work so hard to get money. But if I want things, then I have to work to get them. And from a very young age, oh, that's a cute dress. That's a pretty hat. Oh, this would be something nicer to eat than I've had. Look at this marvelous appliance. My house is too small. I need to redo the pictures. It just goes on and on. We're always restless. So we bring onto the spiritual path this profound sense of incompleteness. Of course, we are incomplete, not because we don't have the right tennis shoes, but because we are not one with God. So we do feel anxious, and that anxiousness eventually brings us to the spiritual path. But then there's two things that I want to say before I finish here. One is, as I was saying, very often we're not failing. We're not being punished. This is what the spiritual path is, that our limitations are exposed, and then we have to put out more energy to, in the right direction than we have put out through many incarnations in the wrong direction. And whether that effort is by right action, right thought, right attitude, or by Kriya Yoga practice, which works directly on the seeds of karma and is a much more subtle form of energy to balance it, we have to pay the debt. That's all. We just have to pay the debt. So the fact that we're in a sinkhole of wrong attitude and wrong energy means that we're just working our way out of that hole. There's nothing wrong at all. The hole was always there. It's progress, as Swami said to me when I was literally weeping over the revelation of a deep fault that I thought I'd overcome. Well, he said, at least you know you have more work to do. He said, you weren't putting out any energy to overcome it, and now you know that you have to. I mean, just such a simple, cheerful, not at all what I wanted to hear message, but that's what we were working with. Now let me just think for a moment what the other thought was that I wanted to offer. Well, it's gone for the moment, but we're just coming back to finish the thought about the chocolate. And then so the story is that Swami never thought to remember, but that one of the members in his congregation, and this is SRF, a church member, just saw these Swiss chocolates for sale in a store at a time when chocolate was not really being imported from Switzerland to America. So it was a rare thing. She saw it. She just felt she should buy it for him. She had no idea he'd gone to school in Switzerland, that he had an affection for chocolate. I don't think she even knew it was his birthday. But on his birthday, he receives this. And Swami remarks, he said, it's understandable that Divine Mother would save my life. You know, I'm serving her. I have a lot of work to do for her. He said, but it was completely unnecessary that she give me chocolates for my birthday. And he said, in some way, it touched him more deeply because it didn't matter at all. And anything that really mattered. Now, there's so many parts of that that are so dear, but the part I was realizing, where I was starting to say, was Swamiji was showing us that we don't have to stop being ourselves in order to be deeply devoted disciples of Master. We can just bring to our discipleship everything that we already are, including an affection for chocolate. Of course, we have to put it into proportion. My happiness doesn't really depend upon it, but there's no harm in wanting it. There's no harm in, well, more deeply, God made us the way we are. He gave us the experiences the way we are. It's rude to our Divine Mother to always think that she made a mistake with me. And there's these many different little clever sayings that people have, I'm God's child and God doesn't make junk. It's sort of a sweet one, but it says that we actually are being rude to God when we denigrate ourselves, because we're the fruit of his labor. And even our errors are the best that we're able to do as his children. And we have to always see it from his point of view. That's all right. That's all right, dear. I know you're messing up now, but you'll get it. You'll get it straight. I mean, that's how a loving mother deals with her child. Sometimes, some consequences are required. Yes, you did that. That was not good. You're not going to be able to go out this whole week because you weren't truthful with me. Consequences are required. But love never stops. And our inherent goodness never ceases. And Master's responding to this with extraordinary expansion of the divine aura that surrounds us. Tomorrow we'll talk more about the implications of that and moving through this small document. God bless you, my friends.